Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and a special guest. Can I call you a friend of the show, Mike? I think you're a friend of the show.
Yeah, more a friend of the show than a friend of Bill.
Yes.
That's very fair.
But you got to admit, it's close.
It's close. You're in the running.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's Mike Siegel performing at Zany's. A strange schedule. You're at the Zany. You know it better than I do.
Tonight and tomorrow downtown on Wells Street, and then Thursday through Saturday out in St. Charles.
Oh,
Pheasant
fun.
Run Resort.
Fun.
Yeah. Yes. I think I probably opened for you there many years ago.
You know, more than once.
More than once.
A couple of times.
So you guys go way back, huh?
Way back. Over 25 years.
At least 25.
I was there when you found out you were having a child, right?
Yes, you were.
Were you the first man to have a child?
Well, that's the way they billed me at Zany's back then.
I didn't believe him at first.
And then Bert said, you should give birth on stage. And I'm like, that's going to take a lot of hydraulics and pulleys. So let's hold off on that.
Hot towels. I don't know what, like in movies, they'll get some hot towels.
The story I always tell about you, and Wendy, maybe you'll remember this, is one time Mike and I were working in Kansas, and we were told, like, you'd always go into the club, and they would give you rules. Like, they'd say, the show starts at 8, but we want you here at 7, and you get 2 free drinks per whatever. They would fill you in on the rules. So they told Mike, in no uncertain terms, at this club in Kansas City, no Vegas walking. And there was even a sign on the door attention all comedians, no Vegas walks.
Can I just tell you, I don't know.
To this day, none of us know what
we don't know what it means.
That is the craziest thing ever.
But to your credit, Mike, like, the owner told us that with a very straight face. Guys, I'm not kidding around on this, no Vegas walk. So then Mike said, what if the crowd wants us to Vegas walk? And he goes, I won't have it in my club. Forget it. I said, what if the show is going really well and we look over and we see you and we nod and we're like, I got a Vegas walk. I don't care what happens. If either of you Vegas walks, you're out the door. It's been 30 years.
We still don't know.
We have no idea what it means.
Yeah, I asked if I could do a Reno walk.
Right. And he
which
thought
is
about
surprisingly
it.
Surprisingly, more acceptable.
He
than
considered
a Vegas
it. He went, I could see where that might happen. All right, that's fine.
Even Googling it now, 20 some years later,
no,
there's nothing.
There's nothing written online.
Nothing.
So that's fine. Can you talk about your days on HGTV?
Sure.
All right. You did not one show.
I did two shows.
Two different shows on HGTV. Talk about the premises of these shows.
One was called If Walls Could Talk, where we would go and talk about the history of old houses. I would go around the country and go into these. And the other one was called What You Get for the Money, where we would just compare home prices around the country. And I didn't go to the actual homes on that second one.
Oh, you didn't?
No. I would just do...
wraparounds in the studios.
So are you a realtor?
Nope.
And why
do you
have to say realtor? You don't say doctor.
Mike, how come?
Realtor.
Yeah.
I'm a realtor, but not
a realtor.
No.
Are you handy?
No. No. And this is why they don't hire me anymore.
Don't say that.
No, it was more about the interactions with the people and their houses. And it's amazing. Anybody who has an old house, every single person will say, are we going to talk about the ghost? Are we going to talk about our ghost? It's like, well, no. Unless the ghost shows up and we can get him on camera. I think, no.
Our house was built in the 1860s. We don't have a ghost.
And you don't think you do?
No, I want a ghost. I'd welcome one.
Yes, most everybody we talk to, if they live in an old house, almost to a person, we have a ghost.
Really? Why does that keep coming up?
I don't know, but if you watch, especially the Travel Channel now, and I do a lot of travel writing and things like that. I have a travel
podcast. Ghost Hunter or whatever.
They've gone all completely paranormal. It's all ghost hunters.
Isn't that odd?
Yeah.
I wonder what's behind
Sasquatch
that.
Sasquatch and all
that. It gets people to tune in.
I guess it got ratings.
Yeah,
Sasquatch visited my house one time in the 1870s.
Mike, could you do something with that at HG?
Yes.
Would they do it?
Is he still in the house? If we can shoot him, absolutely.
Then it's okay.
Yeah.
Then it's
fine. If we can literally shoot him, we can go to the outdoor channel.
You do more traveling than anybody I know. You're always somewhere else. You're always.
I didn't have a nice
country.
Family like you, Bill.
It's to escape your family.
Yes,
Is that why you're traveling?
I'm
so
running
much?
Away from a lot, really.
How many countries? I don't even know if you'll know the answer to this. How many countries have you been to in the last few years?
Last few years,
Or overall?
I know I'm over 100 now.
Over 100 countries,
especially because the last 5 years, 4 or 5 years, I've been doing cruises. So. You count all these little Caribbean islands and stuff like that. Yeah. That pushed me over.
Yeah.
But I was in Africa this summer and that I knew for sure. I haven't done a full count, but I think it's probably, I know it's over 100.
That's so impressive.
Did you do a safari when you were in Africa?
No, actually, yes. Well, yeah, both. I went to the mountain gorillas in Uganda and Rwanda where you can climb up and sit with them and
How cool is that?
It was amazing. It was like a once-in-a-lifetime
thing. In that situation or others, have you ever been afraid for your life?
No.
Never?
No. I went in Uganda where there was about, in this particular forest, it was four particular families that are used to being around people. So you can only spend an hour with them a day.
Yeah.
You know, no more groups of only eight or less.
And some of the gorillas had seen your work on HGTV.
Yeah, they knew me.
All right.
Sure.
What do you do with them? I mean, do you communicate sign language? Do you
there are trackers that lead us to them, and they communicate with like grunts and things, and they know the families, and they know the individual apes and everything like that.
But
and I also learned it's true, ape shall not kill ape.
Well, they say that in Planet of the Apes,
yes,
and it turns out it's true.
No, it's really amazing,
Wendy,
when you sit around with them. And
Wendy does not appreciate Dr. Zayas references before 11 o'clock. Very adamant. No Dr. Zayas
47
references.
47 more minutes.
Right. Then come back with your material. Okay.
I am intrigued by gorillas. There was one at Brookfield Zoo where a baby fell over the edge and the enclosure. Binti Jua, I believe, was the name. And picked up this kid and brought it to, it and take
really
care of
incredible.
It.
Incredible. I mean, they would walk around us and like sit right next to us. And
you weren't scared at all?
Yeah.
Okay. They're giants.
I mean, there's one big silverback male, and then he has, his females, and there's some juveniles and stuff. But the silverbacks are enormous. Yeah, they're really big.
I can't imagine being that close to him and not being a little bit scared.
Really peaceful and magical in a way.
Sure.
And you have eight people with you, so you could always push someone in front of you.
That's true.
If they start getting crazy.
What's the old saying? You don't have to be the fastest one in your group. You just have to be faster than the guy next to you.
Right. That turns out it's true.
Yeah.
What's the most underrated and overrated place? If you read anything about travel, they always mention the places you have to visit before you die. What's the one place that's just overrated and the one place that's underrated?
I mean, there's no place I wouldn't really go back to. Well, overrated, I would say Vegas.
Yeah?
Well, all the walking.
Yes. Yeah,
the Vegas walking.
The Vegas walking.
I'm not a big fan of Vegas, probably because I work there a lot.
Yeah.
And I just find after 2 days, it gets, two days tops. I always tell people when they're visiting, it's just like if they've never been, schedule 2 days. And then they'll say, we're going to be there a week. I'm going, ooh.
Yeah.
In all the times I've been there, when I'm there for 3 days or less, I always have a nice time. But if I'm there for 3 days and an hour... turns in a
second. That's the cutoff?
Yes.
Well, if you work there at a club, you're usually doing about 7 days.
Yes.
And by the fifth day, you're just walking to breakfast through the casino and ding, 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 ding. You're like, okay, I'm done.
Right.
I'm done.
Right. All right. So that's the most overrated.
Underrated, I don't know, just places in like Eastern Europe that I think that people don't know about. There are little remote places of Croatia that I've been to, and Istria and things like that that most people don't know. Most people stay around the coast.
Yeah.
In Dubrovnik and places like that, but there's countries like Georgia that are really, really cool and interesting. And where did I go? I don't know, a lot of honestly, Rwanda.
That's a good place.
It's beautiful. Yeah. It's 25 years.
We hear that. We don't think that.
Yeah, I know. It's like 25 years after the genocide. It was this 25 year anniversary, and it was like one of the most cleanest. Especially for an African capital, we were all amazed.
But I always wonder, Mike, if a place like Rwanda has the Hotel Rwanda legend behind it, if people think of it and they go,
they're fighting
that long
it, for
ago.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if they can recover off that,
anything's possible.
Because it was horrendous.
Yeah.
And we went to the actual Hotel Rwanda. It's
Did
called
you?
Some, I can't remember. It's got a French name now. Everybody's screaming at their phone. Have been
Old Bonpan?
Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
All right, we'll take a break.
Mike
Siegel's here.
Bonpan.
Performing at Zanies all this
nice
week.
Nice Vegas walk.
Thank you, Wendy. Zanies.com has your information. More after this. Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill and Wendy. Our friend Mike Siegel is here. He's a friend of ours. He's a friend of the show's. He'll be your friend, too, if you go and see him at Zanies all this week. Chicago.zanies.com. Don't ask him to Vegas walk. He won't do it. He flat out refuses to Vegas walk. That'll
Does
be
that
a
mean
big
you
mistake.
Have to wear a cape or rhinestones? I mean, I have no clue.
My best guess was that maybe it means don't walk through the audience and maybe and talk to the crowd or something like that. Right. That's my guess.
Right.
That's a good guess.
Yeah.
And my guess, not as good as Mike's, was don't try to sell them $1.99 shrimp cocktails. But there's no way that could be Vegas walking, could it?
Do they really have $1.99 shrimp cocktails?
Oh, not so much anymore. That's the other thing about Vegas and why it's overrated, I think, is only because it used to be a cheap place to go get drunk and have a fun. And now it's just as expensive as any, like, going out in L.A. Sure. or New York or here. It's just like, you go to in the hotels or the bars, they just figured, oh, we can just charge them.
Right.
And they'll
right.
pay it. Right. And they do. You know, they don't give it away anymore. If you're gambling at the table, you can get a free drink.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you walk up to the bar and say, I'll have a martini. Okay, that'll be $18. What?
Wait. How'd that happen?
What? You used to give this stuff. It used to be like $3.
I like that no matter what you see in Las Vegas, there's always a sign next to anything that says, voted number one in all of Las Vegas, yeah. no matter what it is. Right. And you go, who voted this the best French toast in Las Vegas? Do they even have such a thing? Come on. That's crazy. Are you still doing movies and TV shows?
Not as much. No. I've been traveling a lot more.
Yeah.
Doing the I've been on the ships a little bit.
On the ships, Mike?
I am.
Are you?
Performing, yeah.
How is that?
I did Last Comic Standing on NBC a few years ago, and saw me on that. And a guy called me from an agency down in Miami and said, you ever think of doing cruises? And I was like, well, not until I was 60. but
yeah.
And he said, well, give it a shot. And, you know, it's actually worked out pretty good so far.
But well, if you like to travel, I'm sure it works out really well.
Although, you know, cruise travel is not my thing, yeah. really, as a traveler.
Yeah.
But
you don't like wearing the sweaters?
No.
And the Sansibel pants?
Mm-hmm. Doing the lifeboat drill.
Here's what I've heard. You tell me if this is true, that when you work on the cruise ships, they don't let you mingle with the other guests on the ship, that you have to stay separate. Is that true or not?
Well, define mingle. Like I'm not supposed to be in their room. I'm not supposed to be in their rooms, and they're not supposed to come to mine. That kind of thing. But I can. Yeah,
you've broken that law, I bet, more than once. Yeah.
No, it depends on the line, but the ones I do, I can mingle with the guests.
Oh, you're
basically a guest entertainer. I'm not like crew.
Yeah. You
know, I don't have to wear a name tag or anything like that walking through. They have much stricter rules
than
I do.
Did you binge watch a bunch of Love Boat episodes?
You know what? You're funny you say that. When you work Princess, you know, you have closed circuit TV in there.
Yeah.
And they have one channel, totally all Love Boats. And they don't like show them. It's on repeat, but it's one show a day. So they just show the same one every single day.
Oh, why?
Day. I know.
So many great episodes.
But you only stick around for the first 5 minutes because you got to see who the guests are.
Right.
It's like, wait a minute, Carol Channing and the Village People and Fred Willard? Yes.
You can't say no to that.
I don't know where this is going. And Pia Zadora? Yes.
Oh, wow.
Man, I haven't thought of Pia Zadora in many years.
And it's just like that weird of, oh, my God. And the shows are not good. I don't know if you've seen them.
You don't think they hold up, Mike?
Oh, come on. They don't.
Don't say that.
They don't. But
I like that the crew was always hitting on the select. Like, if you went on one of those cruises and you thought, I'm going to go on a cruise and I'm going to meet a girl, and you go, I lost a woman to Adam Bricker, the Dr. Bricker. What happened? That's horrible.
And then Shara was on one where she was snuck in and like sneaking through the border in a laundry hamper. And just like everything about it's so wrong now. Just like, oof.
Have you had any celebrities on your cruises?
I've done some where as passengers.
Uh-huh. Have you?
The coolest one I did was down in Antarctica. I got to go there. So I got to be in a small, but it was a really high-end luxury cruise line. And
that would be all
depends
right.
on what you define as celebrity, but Newt Gingrich and his wife.
Oh, the Gingriches were there.
The Gingriches were there.
Yeah.
And so...
That's impressive.
There you go.
I do not believe
he came to my show. I don't think he did.
Didn't Pia Zadora try to break them up midway through the cruise, Mike? I read that in one of the trades.
Yeah, I think so. I would hate to.
Pia Zadora still
okay,
with us.
Thank God.
Yeah,
she may not be because Bill is known as...
From time to time, I mention an obscure celebrity and then they will die within a few days.
Right.
And then everybody blames me.
Yeah.
Nah.
It's
whatever.
You, the Kiss of Death.
Where have you
That was
not...
your nickname back in the
90s. I was called the Kiss of Death of comedy.
Yeah. She's 66, by the way.
Wow.
Oh,
wow.
I thought she'd be older, quite honestly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yep. Where have you not been? I know you've been to over 100 countries, but which has eluded you that you really want to visit?
I still haven't been to Egypt and Morocco
because
mainland. when I was close, I was going to rush through it. Yeah. I had a limited time. I didn't want to rush through it. I wanted to give it a little more time. And, sometimes it just doesn't work out. I almost did it on coming back from this Africa trip.
Yeah.
But then I looked at what the temperatures were going to be when I was coming back, and it was like 100 and something degrees. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? I'll pick another time.
But you will eventually get there, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it's weird. You can't put these things off too long because politically and things, you never know how things are going to change. I mean, the first time I went to Europe, I look back on this, you know, my first trip ever out of the country.
Yeah.
There, I went to East Germany. There was a Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
There was a Yugoslavia. And like none of these places we would have thought to go. I went to West Berlin, which was wild. And I saw the wall and went through Checkpoint Charlie, that whole thing.
Yeah.
And it's. And none of that's there anymore.
Isn't that crazy?
It was wild.
So it's so good you did it in that order. You got to see all those things.
Yeah.
And, that's perfect.
And then certain places, and I've been to Cuba, which now it's become harder to go to.
Yeah.
It wasn't there for a little while. And
then it was.
And
even going to Jamaica, you had to get permission to fly over it for many years.
Do you remember when we were growing up, you didn't even need a passport to go to Canada or Mexico or anything.
Right.
Just come on in.
At the border.
Yeah, nobody cared.
It's all changed a little bit.
It's changed a lot. 9/11 changed really everything.
It was so great to see you. Good luck at Zany's. Give the schedule again, Mike, just real briefly.
Tonight and tomorrow, 8 o'clock at downtown Zany's on Wells, and then Thursday through Saturday in St. Charles at the Pheasant Run Resort, the Zany's out there.
Go see Mike Siegel. He's very, very
funny.
Two shows Saturday. They're working you like a dog.
I don't know
how you do it.
I'm going to be Vegas limping.
ChicagoZanies.com has your ticket information. Tell them we sent you. Hi, Mike. Great to see you.
You too.
Thank you, Mike.
More after this. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks very much. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Yesterday was a huge day in the life of Daniel Romanchuk. Daniel was the winner for the Chicago Marathon in the wheelchair division. But don't get too excited because this is becoming kind of commonplace for Daniel. This was your fifth overall win for these major marathons, these major city marathons. Correct, Daniel?
I believe so, yes.
Congratulations.
What was your time?
1:30-something.
Wow. Wow. And you didn't just win yesterday. You won pretty easily, didn't you? You beat the second place finisher by quite a long way.
I made a plan. I always try and drive the course a few days before the race and kind of make a plan on what I'm hopefully going to do that day. And so I tried to make a break and at halfway. And so I ended up holding that off until the finish.
Yeah.
So mile 13, you just get this is it. I'm going. This is the halfway mark. Is that was what you plotted out? You were ready to do that?
Yep. So I had a little bit of a backup plan as well, but yep.
Amazing.
Let's talk about the psychology of winning. When you show up in an event like this, is that all that's in your head throughout the day? Is I've come to do this. I've trained for this. I want so badly to win. Is that playing in your head constantly in a marathon?
I'm kind of constantly going over my plan a little bit, yes.
Yeah.
So it kind of that among, you know, there's usually a press conferences and things like that as well. So, yep, it's one of the primary things.
Does that make it easier or harder, all the attention, all the press conference type business? What does that do for you?
It has, it's been a process.
Yeah, I bet.
So that's... I've just one of the great things about so I'm currently out about 2-ish hours south of here at Champaign, and so there's a great group of athletes down there at the University of Illinois, and one of the great things about being down there is just all of the athletes is, you know, we're always, you know, willing to help one another if, you know, if I ever need help with, you know, interviews or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, somebody like Tatiana McFadden, who has a lot more experience in that sort of area, is, you know, we're always willing to help each other.
That's beautiful.
Although you're helping together, you're a big community in Champaign, but then you just beat everybody. Do you feel a little guilty?
Please say no. I hope you don't feel guilty, do you?
While we're all racing, you know, in a way against one another, again, it is, you know, we're a team down there. So you know, I'm always, you know, willing to help, you know, if something goes wrong technically, you know, with somebody's chair, I usually have a lot of spare equipment. And so, wow. You know, we're always willing to help one another.
Yeah. That's great. You're 21 years old. You just won the Chicago Marathon, your wheelchair victory. I am a lazy slug. You have just made me feel uninspired. I mean, look at you. 21. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You don't have to come back with something. I'm just saying, seriously.
Right, he was going to say you are a lazy slug.
Yeah, I know. Whatever.
Say it. Say it.
But it's just so amazing to me. When did you start participating in this? How old were you?
So I started with the Bennett Blazers Physically Challenged Sports Program out of Baltimore, Maryland, when I was 2 years old, and then started racing when I was four.
Yeah.
And so I've done a lot of other sports as well, swimming, basketball, hockey, you know, the list goes on.
That's amazing to me.
If you don't mind, Daniel, can you tell your backstory? Because I'm sure a lot of people want to know how you got to be where you are today. Tell the story. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was born with spina bifida, and so I think when I was about 1.5-ish years old, I don't remember anything. my mom and I were at a spina bifida association meeting, and Tatiana's mom, Debbie McFadden, came up to my mom and said, you know, you should get him involved with the, you know, Bennett Blazers when he turns two, and because that's when they start taking athletes. And so when I turned two, I started going there, and so I got a great foundation there as two wonderful coaches. Their motto is teach kids they can before they're told they can't. And so I got a great foundation there, played all sorts of sports. And then around 4 years ago, my mom had asked me at coming home from some classes if I wanted to try to make the Rio 2016 Paralympic Games.
Yeah.
And so after giving it some thought, I decided to try and go for it. And so we got in contact with the high performance director at the time of track and field, and they put us in contact with Adam Bleakney, the head coach down at University of Illinois. And so we got in contact with him, and I basically asked him if I could come out and train. And so he'd allowed me to come out and train. And so I've been out there for about 4 years now.
Don't you think, Daniel, it would be so easy for anyone, especially you since you're in the room and I'm talking to you, to say, well, I've been thrown something that I can't handle and being an athlete might not be for me, but you turned it around. You said, oh, no, it's exactly for me. This is going to be what I want to do. How did you do that? Because I think a lot of people don't understand the thought process of saying, I'm going to succeed. I'm going to do what I want in life.
I think a lot of that just comes down to, in a way, the support that I've had, you know, from my youth coaches up to now, family, friends, and sponsors, Top End and AIS Construction. They've just, the support that they've given me along the way and has just been incredible. I wouldn't be here without them.
You had you finished the race yesterday, and then you had an interview to do. Weren't you just completely wiped out mentally and physically?
A little bit. I sometimes start thinking, you know, an easy thing to talk about is the weather. It was a great morning yesterday.
Have a go-to on the weather.
Yep.
Part of your celebration last night was, for the first time ever, you had a slice of Lou Malnati's deep dish pizza. Did that change your life a little bit?
Oh, that was great. Absolutely.
That's probably the only way someone could get me to run, if they held that Lou Malnati's in front of me and just, come on, you can do it.
Right. Right. So I'm guessing prior to a race, a marathon, you have to be very careful in the things you eat, I'm guessing, for a little while, don't you?
So a little bit. So yeah. I have tried to, you know, just sort of carb load a little bit, you know, make sure that I'm topped up to complete the whole race.
Mm-hmm. And is that a dramatically different diet from what you're used to eating?
A little bit, not too much. But yeah, just try and concentrate on getting a few more carbs in than usual.
Yeah.
1 hour, 30 minutes, 26 seconds.
Wow.
That time qualified you as a member of the 2020 U.S. Paralympic team, did it not?
Yes.
So what's next for you? When does training start? When? I mean, this is a big thing.
It is. It's a huge honor to be named to the team to, you know, go to the Tokyo Games and represent the U.S. I think it's every athlete's dream to go to a Games and to represent their country.
Yeah.
And so this is a little bit of a change from last cycle with Rio. Is usually a lot of people don't know until around June, I think, of that year.
Oh.
And so this, I think, this allows our coach to kind of concentrate training to get a peak performance at that time and necessarily at trials, where it's a little bit of a juggling act.
I don't know how this works, but you mentioned you have sponsors now.
Yep.
Will those same sponsors hopefully carry over to the Olympics, or is that a whole new set of sponsors? How does that play out?
So that is something that I'm just getting into.
Yeah.
You don't
know yet.
Lou Malnati should sponsor.
They should definitely sponsor. What's wrong with them? Come on, Lou Malnati. I ask because I wonder if people, if private citizens like ourselves, if we have the ability to sponsor you. I don't know the answers to that. So,
so that is actually something I just recently done is signed with some agents right here in Chicago.
Excellent.
So Chicago's Sports and Entertainment.
Oh, the best. They're the best.
So that is something they are they're absolutely wonderful with navigating a lot of this.
Good.
And will your training be any different now that you're looking towards the Olympics?
I let Adam handle a lot of that.
Yeah.
Good. That's a smart move. All right, let's do this. We'll take a quick break and then more with Daniel Romanchuk. Congratulate him. He was the winner yesterday of the Chicago Marathon in the wheelchair division. But he's done it before, but it's still exciting. We'll cover more next. Stick around. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
All I do is win, 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 no matter what. Got money on my mind.
All right, we are talking to Daniel Romanchuk, who is the winner of the 2019 Bank of America Chicago Marathon men's wheelchair race. We were talking off the air, Daniel, about what comes next for you. You just did you rocked the Chicago Marathon and had Lou Malnati's. Then you're going to the New York Marathon next?
Yep. So November is actually going to be a very busy month.
Yeah.
I head from New York straight to the World Championships in Dubai. Mm. And then right after that, I head to Oita, Japan for a marathon there.
Good golly.
That's incredible. The New York Marathon, especially interesting to you because you're the defending champion. You won last year, right?
Yep.
Is the training any different depending on the city? I know some cities are a little more slopey than others. Is your training a little bit different?
Before marathons like New York and maybe Boston, I try and get back to Mount Airy, Maryland, where I'm from, to try and get in a little bit more hill training.
Yeah.
Yes, it does kind of depend on what the course is.
You mentioned you do or have done other sports. Is there something in addition to the marathon that you're doing right now?
Not at the moment, no.
Okay, but the track category includes, like, there's a marathon part of it, and what other events?
The track, I do anything from the 400 up to the 5,000, so 400, 800, 1,500, and 5,000. So I decided to not really do the 1 too much, 100 too much, but pretty much everything on the track.
And that's so different in the way you would perform, because in a shorter race, you have to go for speed right out of the box.
Yep.
The long term, you can, as you waited till halfway and then turned it on.
So yeah, the longer the distance, the more strategies play in.
Daniel, I have a list of sports in front of me. I want to make sure this is all a list that you participate in, right? Not just a list of sports that exist in the world. Because listen to this list. In addition to being a marathon racer, wheelchair basketball, swimming, archery, the triathlon, skiing, sled hockey, track and field, and I saved the best for last, table tennis.
Uh-oh.
All correct.
You play all of those.
Bill.
Yep. Wow.
Bill loves to play. Those of us who don't play very well call it ping pong.
Right.
But you call it table tennis.
If you're serious about it, right, you call it table tennis. That's the official name. Oh, that would be a blast.
You should play him.
Yeah. Anytime you want.
Are
that'd
you
be
good
so much
at
fun.
Table tennis?
Oh, I have not played that for a very long time.
Oh, then we got to play for money. How much money did you bring with you? Oh, that's excellent. But that is quite an array of sports. That's a very impressive list of sports.
So, yeah, so the youth sports program that I'm from is a multi-sport program. So they did all of those.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
Can I ask you a question? A 21-year-old usually is way into video games. Do you play video games too or no?
Yes.
All right, good.
Good.
That's all I wanted to know.
What's your game of choice, Daniel? Is there a special game you like?
Nothing in particular.
Whatever's there.
So yeah, I actually play a lot with my dad's because sometimes he's out in Maryland a lot.
Yeah.
And so that's a way we use to kind of connect.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. All right. Tell me about that minute when you're in a marathon and you've been racing and racing and racing and you're over an hour and a half, you're in that ballpark and you realize, I'm going to win. This is going to be mine. This is going to pay off with a victory for me. What is that playing out in your head like? What's going on for you when you realize that?
So I never say, you know, oh, I've got this until everyone's across the finish line.
Yeah.
You know, anything can happen. A lot of technical things can happen with the chair. So I never consider the race done until everyone's across the line.
Mm-hmm. But then when you do win, time to celebrate.
After a little bit of recovery,
good,
yes.
Good.
We are so unbelievably proud of you. Really, you show that anyone who puts their mind to it can accomplish anything they want. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And if people want to know more about you and your journey through these races, Daniel, there's a website?
I have you can look me up on
Facebook.
Facebook, okay. Number of other Twitter and Instagram as well.
That's Daniel Romanchuk.
Good luck in New York.
Honored to meet you.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
And can we talk to you after you do some major gold medaling at the Olympics coming up? We'd love to keep in touch with you.
I'd great to be back.
Thanks, Daniel.
Awesome. Shake it up, baby, now. Is that okay to say to you, or will
yeah,
I
you can
be in
say,
trouble?
No, you can say that, Wendy. That's fine.
We are in a quandary.
Because why?
Because our next guest, we'll be talking to them in about 7 minutes, excuse me, one of the two authors that pretty much helped ignite a movement. They broke the sexual harassment story involving Harvey.
Harvey Weinstein.
It is Weinstein.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Bob Ferguson is in here messing me up, telling me different names.
Oh, no.
Weinstein.
Yeah. So you're trying to figure out, this is off air, but now we're on air so we can discuss this. What exactly was the turning point? Where exactly we came up with the Me Too movement? And one of your questions that you want to ask, and it's a good question.
Yeah, I just don't want, like, I think the Harvey Weinstein was what started, it prompted the hashtag Me Too movement. Because
mm-hmm.
I kind of want to say that...
Rose McGowan?
Well, Rose McGowan was tweeting some things that were not really coming out in the open. They were hard to understand. It wasn't sure.
Yeah.
And then Alyssa Milano jumped in on this when the Harvey Weinstein story broke.
Right.
And you had mentioned one prior to that.
Well, the Bill Cosby story with Hannibal Buress, the comedian who talked about it on stage, predated the Harvey Weinstein story a little bit, so we're trying to figure out
when the hashtag Me Too started.
I thought
it was him.
I think it's more associated with Harvey Weinstein, but what you had was a couple of celebrities involved in these similar situations in a very short span of time. But you're right. I think it was more than likely it was his story that gave birth to the Me Too movement. I believe. I mean, when she's on, we'll certainly ask her. But it just seems chronologically it would make sense that it was his story that kind of spurned that on.
And we're going to be talking to Megan Toohey, who will be in town. Jody Kantner also co-authored the book. Tomorrow night, the Chicago Humanities Festival at the Vic Theater. It's a 7 o'clock thing. There are some pretty great things happening in Chicago. There's the Ideas Week. We talked to Pete Holmes on Friday about that. This Humanities Festival. I like to feel that Chicago's where it's at.
Yeah. Let me draw another quick parallel. People in the movie industry, like for those of us on the periphery of the movie industry, we would see this guy, Harvey Weinstein. He was a very high-powered movie producer. And you would see him at award shows, and he seemed to be a fun-loving, jovial type of guy. But none of us really knew much about him other than we'd see him at award shows. He was a frequent winner. And then a lot of times, your bigger-name stars, when they would go up to accept awards, would always thank him and talk about, you know, without Harvey, I would be nothing. So for most of us who knew this guy, we knew him exactly as that. But there were always rumblings that behind the scenes, he wasn't that great of a guy. A parallel a little bit to the Bill Cosby story, where most people knew him as America's favorite TV dad, but had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. So there was a very similar vibe to both of those guys' stories.
I still feel duped. I really do.
By both?
And, you know, I know that a lot of people got flack, and I'm kind of thinking Meryl Streep was one of them.
Yes.
Because was constantly seen with him and then claims, you know, she didn't know what was going on. I don't think that's fair because maybe she didn't. I mean, I don't know what you do in your off time. Not that it's anything bad.
Right.
But even though I work with you every day and spend a lot of time with you, and this is less so if they're doing a movie together.
Right.
They don't hang out every day and they're not with each other. So I think maybe she didn't know. And there are other celebrities who maybe didn't know.
Well, the strangest one, and when Megan is on with us, we can certainly ask her about this, is stories have surfaced that Harvey Weinstein, on more than one occasion, came on to Gwyneth Paltrow, who at the time was dating Brad Pitt.
That
she shared that story with Brad Pitt, who did very little about it. And then I think you and I have discussed this on the air at least once. What exactly he could have done and should have done to prevent this. You know, people have said, you know, at the time, Brad Pitt was a young up-and-coming actor. He's not the Brad Pitt of today who holds all the cards, but he was just another actor trying to make it in show business. And Harvey Weinstein at that point could make or break a career. So you say, at what point do you say, hey, I'm putting my career aside. Don't do this to my girlfriend. And he didn't do that. So I'm not blaming Brad Pitt because, you know, it's his call at the moment of what to do or what not to do. But people have said this would have been a good time for him to expose Harvey Weinstein and say, here's a guy who's using his position, you know, for sexual advances and it's not fair. But he didn't do it.
But then there's something to, I'm not saying what their relationship was, but that of trust. I mean, I bet it was hard to believe. I'm still shocked over the Bill Cosby thing. I really am.
Sure. Right.
So if it's someone you've worked with and been with on a regular basis, I think you find it shocking that this information, like, oh, that's terrible. But
yeah. But wouldn't you agree that that list of people goes on and on? I mean, Matt Lauer was back in the news last week for similar things. And for people who watched and loved Matt Lauer for so long, you go, oh, come on, it can't be Matt Lauer.
I watch him every morning.
But those are just some examples. But that list in the last couple of years has just gotten bigger and bigger. Charlie Rose is still a guy that I always think, boy, that's one of the best interviewers of all time is Charlie Rose. But then all that came out about Charlie Rose, you go, oh, how did that happen?
I still find myself a little shocked, but it's more believable now when these first cases, Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein, that was the shocking. Now it's like nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, I understand that. I know.
So she said, breaking the sexual harassment story that helped ignite a movement. It's a book that's out. Megan and her co-author Jody Kantner, they are on tour all over the place, and they will be coming to Chicago tomorrow night, October 15th, from 7 to 8 p.m. for the Chicago Humanities Festival. I guess First United Methodist Church, we'll find out all this information because I have conflicting reports, but that's why they're not in studio together because today's their travel day.
All right, that's
so
fair.
We can take a break. and come back and talk about this. Find out when the Me Too movement kicked in. I'm just thankful it kicked in. That's all I'm going
to
say.
A very, and I'll certainly tell her this. It's a very brave story, one that certainly needed to be told. He needed to be exposed, and they did a great job of it in this book. She said, so, yeah, we'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll talk to her in just a few moments. Stick around. It's Bill F. and Wendy Snyder on WGN.
It's Bill Leff, it's Wendy Snyder, and we are honored to bring you Megan Toohey, who, with Jody Kantner, co-authored this book, She Said, and it is breaking the sexual harassment story that helped ignite a movement. Thank you for doing that, Megan.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Megan, before you joined us, I was saying, for most of us not in the movie business, just fans of the movie industry, you'd see Harvey Weinstein in these award shows. Every once in a while, he was thanked by celebrities or he was being ribbed by a celebrity on stage talking about him. He just seemed like a big, lovable teddy bear. When did you realize he was the opposite of a big, lovable teddy bear? He was a monster. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, you know, that may have been what people were saying on stage or on the red carpet during the Oscars. But the truth is that he had long been rumored to be a sexual predator. It was sort of an open secret in Hollywood. And in 2017, the New York Times said, we're going to actually take this opportunity to investigate these rumors and see if there's truth to that. To them. And sure enough, several months later, we were able to, in fact, expose the fact that this man had engaged in decades of alleged predation on actresses, on young assistants in his companies, and basically that there was a whole machinery in place to help keep it secret.
Including Harvey's brother, Bob.
Right. So when we broke that first story in 2017, we had been able to connect some of the dots. But since then, in the course of reporting this book, we've been able to bring together so many other pieces of the puzzle. And one of the things that we wanted to push into was the question of complicity. And, you know, there were individuals at his companies, the companies themselves, that were ultimately pulled into his alleged predation. And Bob Weinstein, his brother, his longtime business partner, what did he know? When did he know it? And what did he try to do about it? And for the first time, Bob opens up and gave us a series of interviews for this book in which he acknowledged that he was aware that his brother had engaged in this alleged sexual misconduct for years. Bob had actually provided money to help silence a couple of the women who came forward. But like so many other people in Weinstein's orbit, he ultimately looked the other way and failed to intervene.
And Megan, their company, the Weinstein Brothers company, that's completely dissolved at this point, correct? Is it gone?
Right. So this is also, there's so many other kind of moral lessons to the Weinstein story. One of them being that when people and institutions like his company do become complicit and fail to take action, that it ultimately destroyed the company, the company quickly crumbled after we were able to expose what he had been doing for so long to his employees and to actresses.
You know, we were discussing this before you came on with us, Megan, and this was the first hashtag Me Too movement, was it not? Because we had talked about Bill Cosby and what came out prior to Harvey Weinstein, but this is the case that kind of changed everything, didn't it?
Well, you know, Tarana Burke, the activist, had actually started the Me Too hashtag about a decade before. But there was no question that in 2017, with the breaking of the Weinstein story, that it really did help open the floodgates. And for the first time, you just saw women from all different industries coming forward with their own stories of sexual harassment and abuse. And it spread around the world.
She Said is the name of the book, and there is a key Weinstein victim who had been pursued by the press for many, many years, 15 years, and now in this book, this victim is on record?
Yeah, that's right. Her name is Rowena Chu, and she was working as an assistant in Weinstein's company in the 1990s when he allegedly sexually assaulted her. Now, what, you know, the underlying incident was was certainly upsetting for her. But what happened next was also just as upsetting. She, like many other women who had been targeted by Weinstein, was basically forced into a secret settlement. Weinstein basically paid her money in exchange for silence. So she was legally prohibited from telling anybody what had happened to her. She couldn't tell her, she didn't tell her husband for 20 years. If she wanted to see a therapist, the therapist had to sign a confidentiality clause. And so this is another thing that we pulled the curtain back on in our book. These secret settlements are being used to silence women in cases of sexual harassment and sexual assault across the country, across industries. And in this case, you know, 20-something years later, this one particular woman was finally ready to break her silence, even if it meant breaking the secret settlement and potentially facing legal consequences for it.
Megan, as this story was kind of reaching the light, as more and more people were finding out about Harvey Weinstein and his situation for decades, as you pointed out, people have been saying, or people said at the time, well, that's the way the entertainment industry has worked forever. The casting couch, that's not just a term that's come up recently. It's been around forever. It's horrifying to think that anyone could justify that, but you heard those same allegations, right?
Oh, we heard it time when Jody and I were reporting on the Weinstein investigation. I mean, we came up against a variety of challenges, but one of the challenges were just some of the cultural attitudes that we encountered from sources and other people that we were contacting as we were trying to unearth the truth. So many people would tell us, you know, even if you do discover the truth and you're able to publish it, nobody will care. This is just how powerful men behave, not just in Hollywood, but in all different types of industries. And I think that what we've seen over the last 2 years is that there were also a lot of cultural attitudes that said, no, that's not the case. Right. This is not acceptable. And men are going to be held accountable.
A terrible moment that was televised was the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and I just remember it being on at work and at home and people watching it and people picking sides. And now Christine Blasey Ford talks about her journey into testifying. That's in She Said as well, correct?
That's right. You know, we didn't want to stop this book with the moment when we published the Weinstein story. That would have been too easy. We really wanted to push into the year that followed as the Me Too movement took off in earnest. And things actually got more complicated. You know, there were a lot of questions about what did it look like? You know, what does fairness look like? What does due process look like? You know, both accusers and the accused felt like there weren't adequate reforms to make sure that everybody was being treated fairly. And we really felt like when Christine Blasey Ford testified in Washington about being allegedly sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh, it was really one of the most visible She Said stories of the Me Too movement and one of the most complicated ones. Some people saw her as a hero. Other people saw her as a victim. And when we were able to obtain the first interviews of her and start to piece together the behind-the-scenes story of her testifying, of her path to testifying in Washington, we realized it was so much more complicated than either side knew.
This isn't fair, Megan, to ask you this question because we only have a minute, but I'm curious. Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt play a role in Harvey Weinstein's downfall. Just your thoughts in less than a minute about the part they played and what should have played out with them.
Well, we're so excited with this book. We've really worked to bring things that were off the record during the course of our investigation onto the record.
Yeah.
And what you meet in these pages are some of the sort of surprising heroes, the people who helped bring the truth to light, Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt among them, and some of the surprising figures who helped cover it up, including Lisa Bloom, one of the most famous feminist attorneys in the country, who was by Weinstein's side.
I can't, I want to say congratulations and I want to thank you for all you've done about this book. It's called She Said. Jody Kantner will be with Megan Toohey tonight. And Megan, this is, or tomorrow night, 7 o'clock
tomorrow
at the
night.
Vic Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chicago Humanities Festival. Really, congratulations and thank you for all your hard work on this subject. We owe you a lot of gratitude here.
Well, we're so excited to be heading to Chicago tomorrow. So thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Take care, Megan. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
The book, again, called She Said, available wherever books are sold. Pick up a copy.
Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn.
Zorn, Zorn. We sing the praises of Zorn.
A very busy Eric Zorn joins us. You've already said it's been a very busy morning for you.
It's been a busy morning, yeah. We had an interesting announcement at the paper. Our editorial page editor,
John?
John McCormick,
yeah.
is resigning in a couple months. And it's tough news. I you know, John and I don't agree politically, the editorial board, but he's a great guy to work for and a very supportive person. He literally needs to spend more time with his family and so on. So he's a good guy, and we were all pretty shocked by it.
I like what you just said, because it mirrors what's gone on with Ellen DeGeneres and George W. Bush, where you said, we don't agree politically, but he's a great guy.
Yes, except John's not a war criminal, and that's a
wow.
But no, it's very interesting. People say, like, you know, how do you, because the Tribune editorial board is more conservative than I am.
Yeah.
And I sit among them. I go to their meetings and I answer to the editor, and people say, how do you work with those people? And I say, they're really smart people who are really supportive and friendly.
Yes.
And we, just because we don't agree on politics, doesn't mean we can't be friends and friends.
But you just threw out the war hero thing there. That make that kind
well, that
of
was,
just...
No, that was Ellen DeGeneres and George Bush.
Right. I know, but I mean, that's what people are doing, you know, throwing that out there. I don't agree with George Bush's politics, but if he was still drinking, I'd have a beer with him.
Well, he just looks good, I think, in comparison to Donald Trump. And that's why people are having nostalgia for him a little bit. But but you got to remember the Iraq War and some of the other things. Darlene Glanton has a very good column in the Tribune this morning about why Ellen DeGeneres should not have been breaking bread or whatever.
She said she shouldn't have been. But was the same criticism there? I'm not thinking of this. Other people have thought of this. I'm just kind of reiterating it, that Michelle Obama has had more than one episode where she's been next to George W. Bush and they have shared a laugh.
He gave her a cough drop.
Yes, he did.
Aren't there people that you work with that you don't agree with things that they do? Maybe you've heard stories, but you're still cordial to them.
Yes. I mean, cordiality is one thing. But I think that when Ellen... some people felt that Ellen went too far over the top in talking about what a great guy George Bush is in private. And I'm sure George Bush is a very congenial fellow. He seems like
he'd be a fun guy.
He does seem like a fun guy. You have to forget about some of the things that he did when he was in office. So, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I
can separate the two.
Certainly in terms of our day-to-day lives, we have to learn how to separate some of those things, because this country is really, really polarized.
Going to hell in a handbasket.
Right. One thing, I mean, this is just sort of draws into what's going on in the news right now, is there are a lot of people who really enjoy how disruptive Donald Trump has been. They feel like, well, the fact that he makes people like Eric Zorn mad means that that's enough for me right there. and yet, all that stuff is having been said. You know, he has these rallies where he swears and he makes fun of AOC and he makes fun of Hunter Biden and all this chaos that he foments.
Yeah,
the chaos that he's fomenting right now in Syria is really serious stuff.
Sure, it is.
This is people are dying.
Lives are being lost.
The Kurds are dying. We're betraying an ally, someone who helped us in the fight against ISIS. We are totally betraying them. We're letting them be slaughtered over there because of this bizarre, clumsy foreign policy that Donald Trump has been exercising. And so suddenly, this is the kind of thing that I think a lot of people who are conservatives, but not, you know, they're not wild about Trump, but they've been staying loyal to him. I think this is the kind of thing that's going to start peeling them away. It's already peeled away a few people like Mitt Romney, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're going to see more of them saying, "Wait a minute, you know, yeah, it was all fun and games when he was calling people names and being disruptive and unconventional. But that this kind of unconventionality, this kind of foreign policy, where we, you know, he has a conversation on a Sunday night with the strongman leader of Turkey, and then the next day he announces that we're pulling our troops out, and suddenly the Turks go in, and now they're slaughtering the Kurds, and the Kurds are now going, and they're going to align themselves with Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who is in league with Putin, and all these ISIS prisoners are being freed from their prisons in northern Syria, and this is bad. This is, you know, you talk about this, you know, the impeachment
Yes.
Issue that we've been dealing with.
Yes.
But this particular issue, I think, is going to hit home with a whole swath of conservatives and Republicans who are unmoved by some of the other stuff that Trump said. When Trump says, oh, yeah, China should investigate Joe Biden, and he has this phone call that,
right.
That we've read about. I think a lot of people have been saying, oh, that's just a witch hunt. It's just noise. This is, I think, a different thing. I think this is a different kind of crisis for his presidency, because the one thing that he needed to do, all he needed to do, was to keep those Republican senators in line as the impeachment inquiry goes along, because the Democrats are almost certain to vote to impeach him. They're not going to do a, oh, never mind, you know, we looked into
it. Not at this point.
Not at this point. They're too far in.
So yeah.
They're going to do that. And as you know, an impeachment is like an indictment. It's not... People confuse the language when we're not thinking about this a lot. They think, oh, impeach means you're gone. No, if you're impeached, you're sent over to the Senate for a trial. There's a red wall right now of senators who are not going to – you need two-thirds of the Senate to vote to impeach, and that's just not going to happen.
Right.
So, well, I should say it wasn't going to happen 2 weeks ago for sure.
But now because
of
this?
There's a chance. It's a small chance, but now you may see that some Republicans are saying, "Look, we don't want to ride this horse in 2020. We want to move our party on because he's destroying our party. We are running the risk of getting clobbered at the ballot box. Trump could win, but a bunch of senators could go down over this. And so I could actually see this being an excuse like, well, you know, the other stuff is just a witch hunt, but not this. This has crossed a line, because it really has crossed a line for a lot of Republicans.
When they vote on impeachment, is their vote public record or not public record?
Yes, of course.
It is.
Yes, yeah.
Do you think that influences some votes?
Well, yeah, I'm definitely. It does.
Why can't they make it like a private thing?
Like a jury, you mean, where they go back into the room and argue it out? It's interesting. I think probably in part because it is a political act. Impeachment and removal are both political acts, so you want to have your political acts.
But couldn't you make the argument, based on what you just said, that it's in the best interest, or better interest anyway, for that particular vote to be a private
situation? That's a really good question. It's a good thought, too, because you're probably right. That, and you hear this all the time on the chat shows, which is Republicans saying, people saying, oh, I talk to Republicans all the time, and they're all privately mortified about Trump. They're all like, wash their hands of him, but publicly they come out, and I mean, they're like the Lindsey Graham people who are like, oh, he's a great man, our president, but secretly they're like, wow, I wish we could get rid of this guy. But they're all afraid of him because he attacks. He's a very good attack dog.
Uh-huh.
So this is a very interesting, it's a pivotal point. It's come so quickly after the whole Ukraine thing, right?
Yeah,
the whole transcript of the phone call, and the Democrats were all upset about that, and then they do the impeachment inquiry, and then following right after this, he has the Senate. He doesn't, you know, there's no way he's going to lose those votes in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly he makes it, maybe he will lose them. Maybe they will just say, look, we cannot have 5 more years of this kind of foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
That this may spiral the Middle East way out of control again, a situation that was getting somewhat stabilized over there. So I'm interested in watching that.
Thank you for teaching me a new word, foment. I had to look
foment.
It up.
Foment.
You know what it means, Bill?
Not positive.
I had to look it up, and I'm going to use it in my vocabulary from now on. It's to instigate or stir up.
I thought you just said ferment incorrectly. I thought you were saying
you're
it just
very
a little.
Politely,
I didn't want to correct you.
Speaking of words, I have another thing to talk
about. Wait, Eric,
words.
Not yet.
Oh, okay.
We'll take a break, and then Eric Zorn has something else to discuss with you, so stay where you are. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN. I have a leftover question for you, Eric, from segment one, but I think it still holds true today. The identity of the whistleblower or whistleblowers should or should not be made public.
Should not be made public. Absolutely not. You know, that ad for Permaseal reminds me of a joke.
What is the joke?
It's an old joke. A guy's going down the road, and it's raining, and a guy's sitting on his front porch, and the water's pouring in, and he says, hey, farmer, well, you know, your roof is leaking. Why don't you fix it? He goes, I can't fix it. It's raining.
Yeah.
The guy says, well, why don't you fix it when it's not raining? He goes, well, it doesn't leak then. Anyway, I should do stand-up, shouldn't I?
You should definitely be doing stand-up. Performing. Come on.
So speaking of, we're talking about language and words.
Yes.
I did an item in my Sunday column. You know, there's lots going on in the world, and this was the thing that leapt to the top of my column. The Bears did not play on Sunday.
No.
And it's widely said that they had a bye week.
Yes.
Now, you know, Bill, you play tournament tennis, so
yes.
You know what a bye is.
I have no idea.
You really don't? No.
No.
It's a free pass to the next round.
Well, I know what it is. I don't know where the derivative of the... I looked into this.
I don't... It's hard to tell because bias is, you know, it's a word. It's just a word that's lost to antiquity in some ways. But it has been used since, I think, the 1500s. And it comes from cricket. The sport of cricket, and I guess if you miss the wicket and the guy behind the wicket doesn't get the ball, then the guy gets to run. It's kind of like a wild pitch, I guess, in baseball. And it's called a bye because you get a run, but the batsman didn't do anything.
Yeah.
So in a sense, it's like you're getting an advantage by not doing anything.
Right.
And in tournaments, so the term then, I guess a couple hundred years later, became used in tournament play where you would say, like, okay, when you have like an uneven number of competitors, like you've got nine people and one of them gets a bye into the next round.
Yeah.
That doesn't have to play. And they sort of, it's like you're assumed a victory over a phantom opponent in a sense. You don't have to play, but you get to advance in the tournament.
I wish all the Bears games were bye weeks.
Well, but things are
that would be all right.
That we'd win.
It's not a bye, and this drives me crazy.
It's not, is
yes,
it?
I looked in the news archives. I found references going back to the 1930s, where when football teams have the day off, it was referred to as a bye. And this it was used occasionally up into the 60s, and in the 1960s the NFL used to have a week off, and then they stopped, and there was a period from like the 66 to 90 where every Sunday your team played throughout the whole season.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1990 they began this process of giving each team an idle week, 1 week off, and that allows them to extend the season to make it longer for advertising purposes. Wow. For TV contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So you have like a, I think it was at that point.
You mean they're doing this for financial reasons,
yes,
Eric? I can't believe
you think just for the pure sporting.
Wait, I thought like if you had a Thursday night game, then you wouldn't play Sunday because of a time restraint more than to extend the season.
Well, that is
a bye.
Well, when did they start doing? No, that's not a bye. But they used to do. They didn't. This was before Monday night football first, and then they did Thursday night football.
But they still called it Monday night football, even though it was on Thursday.
That's a bye. That's wrong.
Yeah. If I had known that, I would have written a column on
that.
If
you play on Thursday, you don't then play on Sunday. Thursday is your Sunday game.
Right.
You're playing the week. You're just playing a different time during the week.
Yeah.
And so they started doing this. And for some reason, sports writers and everybody else started just calling it a bye week. And it has nothing to do with a buy, and there's no sense. You're just off.
There's no advantage.
It's just you don't get an advantage. They don't say, oh, you we're going to give you a victory this week. We're going to pretend that you won the game, and yet this has become such common usage. And I felt like I was becoming one of those curmudgeons who's
You are.
Yeah,
but you definitely are
railing against this usage that's so common that.
But look at in baseball and the playoff structure of baseball. Every team that makes the playoffs, with the exception of the wild card teams, does get a bye. They don't have to play that first round, which is a one game
play in.
So it would be accurate there, but it's not called a bye week there.
When you have a day off in baseball, sometimes a team will have a Tuesday or Monday off. They don't call it a bye.
What about hockey? They go back to back to back to back.
But when they have a game off, they don't call it a bye. They're just off.
So the correct terminology would be and should be what?
An idle week or an off week. Off week, yeah.
But the Bears have had off weeks for the last 6 years.
And they're idle frequently as well.
Yes.
That's true. So anyway, I made a stink about this, and of course sports fans push back. They always do.
What was the pushback?
This is the way people talk. And it's true. You know, there are, you know, those of us who like to try to hang on to the original meaning of words, and you know, decimate used to mean cut into 10 pieces and now it means just to destroy something and so on. And a lot of people think that literally and figuratively are now because people use literally to mean figuratively all the time. Like, that book literally exploded in my hands, you know.
I use a word incorrectly, and I don't know who started it, but it's not just me. When I think something's really funny, I'm like, that's hysterical. That is not, my 16-year-old corrected me. He's like, it should be, that's hilarious. Hysterical means someone's in hysterics and going crazy.
But you can laugh hysterically.
Yes, you can.
And you know, Wendy, that's considered to be a sexist term. Because hyster comes from...
Hysterectomy.
The same root as hysterectomy. Yeah, so it's...
Say hysterectomy from now on instead of hysterically.
Yeah, that's
hysterectomy.
That is hysterectomy.
If you say a joke is hysterical, you're clearly, that's positive. But if you say, she's hysterical, she's carrying on. People used to say it about Hillary Clinton whenever she would raise her voice.
Exactly.
She's hysterical. And that was, you know, linguistically, it's a sexist insult. So.
And it's used incorrectly. It should be hilarious.
Right. And again, I try not to be too much of a fuss pot about language, but this bothers me every year. The Bears have a week off, and they say it's a bye week. It's not a bye week.
Also in sports, here's a couple. It's been a thing now forever in baseball. It was the leader in RBIs. He's got 80 RBIs. He's got 115 RBIs. But now that term is being called RBI instead of RBIs because it's not run batted ins.
It should be RSBI.
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 Do they now say, is that now how they say it?
A lot of announcers have switched to RBI.
He has 49 RBI.
Yeah. Some are not, though. Some are saying, no, it's been RBI since the beginning of time.
Can I get a column out of this?
That's an easy
ribbies.
Column.
Ribbies. I like to call it ribbies.
Ribbies. That's a good one.
And then the other one is one that I think we talked about with you recently, I think, and that is that in pro sports, most notably football and basketball, they don't want to call the owners of teams owners anymore.
Right. I think the NBA distanced themselves from...
Yeah.
This is news to me. Yeah. I heard this last
because
week for
owners,
the first time.
Because most of the people who have controlling financial interests in teams are old white men,
yeah.
And a lot of the players in the NBA are African-American.
Yeah. So that.
So what do you could just manager?
Owner. No,
see?
Oops.
What
do you say? Bye?
No.
Hysterical?
I don't know. Hysterical.
Yeah, hysterectomy.
Hysterical men.
That's how it is. We solved some problems, didn't we, Eric?
We did.
That's Eric Zorn. Read him in the Chicago.
And created some new ones.
And we started way more new ones than we let go of.